It looks like it's recording now.
Yeah, now it's recording.
The
Okay,
red
so I'll
thing.
do a quick. We're talking about loneliness and Jewish thought, and I pointed out that the first thing that happens in the Torah to the first human being is that the human being is alone, and God said, "Is it isn't good," and we have a sense that somehow it's that's very important. That before there can be human beings interacting with each other, there has to be a sense of what it means, what absence is before there can be presence, before there can be connection. That's interesting, right? Because if you think about it, you could imagine a human being who's so sort of satisfied that they're not alone, right? Why don't we say, well, Adam, if he was a really creative human being, if he was really a tzaddik, if he was really preoccupied in his mind with higher things, maybe he wouldn't be alone. Maybe he'd be fine just being by himself. So that's it's interesting that the Torah doesn't have that paradigm, right? That the Torah has a human being. Somehow it is as it says in she Koheles Tov Mashnayim Min HaEchad. Somehow two is better than one. So the Kleyaker, another classic commentary in Torah, says Lo Tov Yasam Lo, it's not good for the human being to be alone. It says, whenever there is division, hatred, machlokes, there's no goodness there. Kitov, that's why it doesn't say kitov was good on the second day, because on the second day nothing was created. Rather, the waters were split. When things are split apart, when there's a lack of unity, that's not good. Fishabon nivra machlokas, because that's when division was created. Kichol mispar shnayim yesh bo chalukah upirud. Whenever there's two is dangerous because two means it's not one, it's not unified. So when God splits the waters, there's machlokas, there's separation, lack of unity. So if God would create the human being, each a separate human being, you have two people who are separate. That's lacking unity. They would be two separate individuals. Here, I think what's bothering him is why does God have to create Chava from Adam? Why doesn't God just create the two people together, as God seems to do in the first chapter? So he's saying because if you create two separate people, somehow you can't have unity. If two people are really separate, you can't have unity, and goodness is only a product of unity. So why is this any better, right? So he creates Chava from Adam, but there's still two separate human beings that have to come back together, and they have their own troubles in life with each other. So why is that good? So somehow I think he's reflecting this Midrashic idea that the fact that they were one makes their unification more significant. In other words, if they were never one. Right, we even have this term in English, soulmate. We have a sense that, just like the Midrash says, that two people who find each other, if it's the right match, there's somehow a sense that oh, they're connected, more than just two people coming together who were not connected and now are connected, but somehow that there's something deeper. Somehow that there's a unity that they are reconnecting with. That's what he seems to say that and. My thought about that is that I think human beings, I think the greatest fantasy of human beings is to marry themselves. I think we all, on some level, look for ourselves. Because we get along, we are ourselves. And it's hard to have a partnership with someone else because other people have other desires, other needs, other thoughts. You're never totally on the same page. It's impossible to be. If two people are independent human beings, if two people are individuals, so that's very hard, right? That's why most marriages end in divorce, because it's very difficult. And so in a certain way, like the ultimate would be, a solitude that wasn't lonely, meaning you sort of, in a certain way, the perfect person is us, right? You have somebody describe their perfect spouse, on some level, often it's we think that about ourselves. But that can't work. That's not real. That's not real relationship. And so on some level, I think human beings can end up being frustrated in relationships. So it's important that even though Adam and Eve are going to be connected, they're going to be in some level against each other. They're going to challenge each other. A good relationship, they're supposed to be separate. They're not supposed to be the same person. They're supposed to both be independent, right? That's azer kenegdo. That's the kenegdo part. But at the same time, they are made from the same. There's an identity. They can identify with each other. And then they can cross the Rubicon of loneliness, right? Because ultimately, really, we never achieve the solution to loneliness, because the reality is that we can never fully know anyone else, right? No matter how long you're married to them, you know a lot about them, can never really know what it's like to be them. You can't. You can't. It's impossible. And on some level, you know, and every, you know, every therapist will tell you that every relationship is a risk by definition, because every relationship ends in loss. Someone, even if it's a great relationship, somebody dies. It always has to end. And so there's a, I think there's a sense that that by definition, built into being human is a kind of existential loneliness. You may not feel lonely, you may have people around you that you love, but ultimately you are an island. Ultimately, you can never traverse the distance between oneself and others, really. Really, that's the so Adam and Eve, I think what the Torah is trying to achieve here is trying to solve that a little bit by making Adam and Chava from the same thing. I think maybe that's what the Klei Yochar is sort of pointing out. That the two independent beings come together, they can't solve loneliness, because if they're too dependent on each other, that doesn't solve it at all. There has to be otherness, there has to be separateness, there has to be independence. And then when they come together, that can be a good relationship. And so you need both, right? There's a sort of back and forth, this dialectic between separateness and togetherness. You can't just have togetherness, because then that's not a real relationship. But if you only have separateness, so how do you achieve that? How do you solve that? So in the Torah, the answer is they're separate human beings, but they come from the same stuff. And then they can achieve sort of reuniting in some meaningful way. Shlomo Lev Lutzado says a similar thing to the Mefarshim above, that there has to be a sense of aloneness first. Okay, that's the human being, right? It's the most fundamental aspect of the human being to begin with is aloneness. So I want to actually talk about the loneliness of God. That sounds a little bit heretical, but it's actually a Medrash. The Medrash says, in fact, Shlomo Carlbach wrote a song about this Medrash. That goes, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Vayayavi, you probably heard it before. It's basically this Medrash, that's what the song is. So the Medrash is based, the Medrash Rabbah says, Rav Brechia B'Shem Rabbi Simon Omer, Ein Kokel Yishurun. It says in the Torah, there is no God who is straight like our God. In Kokel Yeshurun. The song is called Niskov, Niskov Hashem Levado, Niskov, Niskov Hashem Levado. Somebody asked me in the chat. So he says, who is like God among Yeshurun, among Israel? Yisrael Saba, the grandfather Israel. Who's that? That's Yaakov. How is Yaakov like God? Ma'akadosh Baruch Hu Ksivbo, it says about God in Yeshayahu, the Niska of Hashem Levado by Yamahu. It's talking about the time of the Messiah, that God will be God will be exalted on that day. Levado, right? Levad, alone. It's the same word as Lo Tov Hei Yota Adam Levado. It's not good for the human being to be alone. Because what is most alone? Of course, God. God is the ultimate aloneness. So, Af Yaakov, Ayivater Yaakov Levado. When Yaakov leaves Lavan's house, it'll be in another parsha, he wrestles with the angel. The introduction to wrestling with the angel is Vayivater Yaakov Levado, that Yaakov went alone. And he crosses over the river. He leaves his wife and children on one side of the river, crosses back over the Yabok River, and that's when he wrestles with the angel. But that is introduced by the words, Vayivasi Yaakovada, that Yaakov went back alone. The Medrash says, Vayivasi Yaakovada ve'e ve'kishimo. It's the Medrash. So it's interesting, right? How is Yaakov similar to God? It's very strange. In their aloneness. I guess we could ask the question of why do we compare Yaakov and God specifically when Yaakov is alone going to wrestle with the angel? I mean, what's the connection? It's a very tenuous connection. How is Yaakov like God? Well, Yaakov was once alone and God is alone. I mean, that's a very strange medrash. So there must be something medrash trying to teach us. The question is, what's medrash trying to teach us? It obviously must have something to do with Yaakov's aloneness being significant, right? Because it could have said, oh, Adam is like God. It says, lo tov heyosa adam levado. It's not good for the human being to be alone, and God is alone. So why don't we say that? Now, maybe it's because over there it's not good. But this aloneness, perhaps, of Yaakov, maybe it's a good aloneness, right? It's an aloneness that leads to a very significant episode in his life, right? The episode of wrestling with the angel. Why is it? I mean, what is it about Yaakov at that moment that makes him like the divine? I guess that's the question we could ask. I'm not even sure I know the answer. So any answer will do. Now, of course, it's the moment when he gets his name, Israel, right? There's struggle. It's dark. He's alone. It's very... By the way, what's fascinating about it is that on his way to Lavan's house, he has the dream that the angel is going up and down the ladder, and he calls that Beit El, the house of God. At the end of this episode, when Yaakov is alone in the dark and he wrestles with the angel, what does he call it? He calls the place Peniel, the face of God. That somehow he finds more intimacy with the divine in this profound aloneness. It doesn't say he's alone when he's on his way to Lavan's house. Here it says he's alone. It's in this aloneness that he finds a similarity to God. He finds God's face in this aloneness in a way that he doesn't find it at any other time in his life. And that's why he names the place, I think, Peniel, the face of God. So there's something about aloneness, about, you know, obviously this is not an aloneness like Adam's aloneness, that it's not good. This is obviously very profound aloneness. This is an aloneness that's somehow more like solitude, perhaps. Something very transcendental, something very profound.
Like a contemplative or meditative time.
Seems like that. I mean, it's obviously a very spiritual episode, right? I mean, he fights with this angel.
Why did Torah use a different word to describe it?
Why doesn't he use a different word?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of alone? I mean, he was alone. I guess the question is, why is it important to be alone? In other words, why can't this wrestling with the angel happen when he's with his family? Why does he have to leave his family and be alone? There's some kind of profound solitude and aloneness here. It seems to facilitate this wrestling with the angel, which then produces Peniel, the face of God. Why? I mean, I guess that's the question. How does aloneness facilitate that? This is obviously not a bad aloneness, like Adam's aloneness. But why would solitude produce something?
It gives you time and space to be when he's with his family and everything going on. There's no time to...
Right. So there's something very... There's a quality about solitude, about aloneness. You know, there are people who cannot be alone. It drives them nuts psychologically. And there's something up with that. There's something negative about that. A person who cannot be alone means that they somehow can't be themselves. They're not happy just being themselves. They have to be distracted. That's like a big, you know, psychologically, I think it's a big red flag. Because there's a quality to aloneness, there's a quality to solitude, there's a reflective nature. In some ways, one might say the human being is most profoundly themselves when they are alone, actually. That's hard. People have different personalities. Some are extroverts, some are introverted. But on some level, we are, as Sarah said, we're distracted when we're with others. Even if we're not distracted, we're distracted because we're not, can't totally be. You can totally, if you're really alone, you could totally be yourself, right? Whatever that means. You know, it may not be that you're acting any different, but you feel different, right? If there's really nobody around, then
I think you find, I think you can find that out, or I found that out during the being alone for Pesach, and
right,
and right. this whole COVID. Virus.
Yeah. So that's a good point, right? In other words, I mean, that's what this has to do with COVID. On the one hand, we are very alone, right? We are really alone during COVID. We're missing shul, and we're missing community, and we're missing people. And that's very negative.
I feel that I am alone physically, but I really don't feel that. I have so many stimuli in the house of books and things that I'm, projects that I'm doing. I don't really feel alone. Right. I don't have family around me, but it's okay.
Right. That's interesting. So you have to be happy being with yourself.
Yeah.
On some level. Yeah. Yeah. If you're not, it's very hard. Yeah. Some of us are very happy to be alone. Nobody's talking us to China. It's even better.
That's the solitude.
Yeah. When you're rabbis, no solitude. No, I'm just kidding. I want to go down a little bit. I found an interesting article in a philosophy journal. This is by a guy who wrote a journal article in a philosophy journal called Man and World. He's from the Department of Philosophy in Montreal. So he's writing about loneliness, and he actually divides loneliness into about 7 or 8 different categories: existential loneliness, cosmic loneliness, personal loneliness, and it's a complex article, but he says that with reference to its nature, it's sort of a general introduction. Loneliness can be defined, considered in, say, as a non-constructive, and if sufficiently relentless and intense, the sort which the central concern of this presentation, as a disagreeable and debilitating way of feeling apart from others rather than being part of them. Of course, loneliness, like any suffering from, can be utilized as a suffering towards, to use Viktor Frankl's terms. Mental and moral growth by means of greater sensitizing, refining, deepening, and purifying one's being. Very interesting. Here, I don't think he's talking about, you know, the pleasure of being alone or solitude. Here, somehow, he's talking about suffering, that there is a type of suffering that is not productive. But as Viktor Frankl said, there are types of suffering that actually prompt us to become deeper. Right? He Viktor Frankl, somebody went through the very famous writer, went through the Holocaust. And he writes about the idea of how people who survived the Holocaust often had a sense of why, of purpose, and that suffering can be a suffering not from, but a suffering toward. There can be a creativity in some way about suffering. There can be a movement toward some greater good or greater goal about suffering. He says here, perhaps it's about sensitizing, refining, deepening, purifying one's brain. So I'm not sure about that. Dana, do you agree with that? Is that true for you? Is that true of loneliness? Is there a loneliness that can be debilitating? On the other hand, a loneliness that even though it's not pleasurable, it can be profound? You know, maybe it gets us in touch with things we don't like about ourselves. I don't know. He says a little bit more. He says loneliness not only refers to the absence of the desired other's presence, right? It's not just that I want somebody to be here and they're not, but this very absence is perceived as a presence, albeit a presence that is felt in the manner of an absence. Now, that's a little confusing. But what he's saying is that it's not just that the other person's not here, but that real loneliness is a loneliness in aloneness that becomes a presence. It becomes a something, something negative. But a something. It's not just an absence of someone. Something else takes its place as a deprivation of the other, right? It's more than just the person isn't around, right? This is reminiscent of, right, my wife's out of the house, so she's not around, so maybe I miss her, but it's not a profound loneliness. But imagine if a loved one dies, right? So why is that different than them being out shopping, right? I mean, sure, I know that in the future they're going to come back, and the one that's not going to come back, but it's a different thing. In other words, there's a profundity about it that creates a presence rather than just, it's not the same as just the person's not around, much more than that, much more than that. Hence, it's not only the other's absence and the felt presence of its absence that constitute loneliness, it's also that this absence creates a lack or loss within the lonely self, so someone feels porous and drained. In other words, it's not even just loneliness, it's something more than that. Consequently, when the other is absent, the lonely person feels that something is wanting within oneself. This is very interesting. So he's saying that loneliness, the type maybe that Adam felt, the loneliness which is really difficult and debilitating, is a loneliness that it's not just that that person is gone. It's that that person's absence makes me lack something internally. Right? That's is a little bit like Freud wrote a book called Mourning and Melancholia, where he compares mourning and depression. He said, what's the difference between mourning and depression? So he says, mourning is when you mourn the loss, obviously, of somebody. He says, but depression is when you lose something and it's a loss of self. When you lose somebody, and it's not just the loss of that person, if it's the loss of that person, you can mourn and then you can move on with your life. But if that person's loss, if somehow you were dependent on that person for your deeper identity, and that person's loss creates a lack of oneself, so then that's depression. That's not a mourning process that you go through and then you move on and you take them with you. Somehow it has stabbed you. It has taken you with them. When that happens, then you have depression, Freud said. So that sounds a little bit like the distinction that this philosopher is making. One feels emptied, lack of intimacy, and hollowed, the lack of meaning. Right? It's very different than what Viktor Frankl was saying, which is that sometimes in loneliness there can be meaning, but sometimes just the opposite. When the desired other therefore remains present in its absence, it's kind of emotional. Okay, I'm gonna leave that. And I wanna compare this a little bit to Rabbi Soloveitchik actually wrote quite a bit about loneliness, right? The loneliness of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And that is, of course, in a very famous book that he wrote. It's an essay, you can probably get it for free online. And it was called The Lonely Man of Faith. He wrote it, I think, in the 60s. I think he wrote it after the death of his wife, Tanya. And I think that he dedicated the book to her. It's a thin book, The Lonely Man of Faith. And in it, he begins the book by, in the beginning of the book, this is actually the beginning of it, very beginning. But then much of the first part of the book is a comparison of what he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam and Eve in the first chapter of Bereshit and Adam and Eve in the second chapter of Bereshit. And he says, Adam and Eve in the first chapter of Bereshit are very different than Adam and Eve in the second chapter. I mean, the first chapter created together, go out into the world. They just want to conquer the world. Now the world works. They're not alone. They're not wondering who they are and why they're here. He says, but Adam and Eve in the second chapter, Adam is alone. And that aloneness, he says, is very profound. That aloneness is a kind of, it's asking the question of what am I doing here? What's the deal with all of this? And then Adam and Eve together form a kind of what he calls covenantal community, a community with God. But that's not something that Adam and Eve do in the first chapter. Adam and Eve in the first chapter are just told, go out and conquer the world. In theory, that's what they do. But in the second chapter, because there's aloneness first, there's a profundity, there's a reflectiveness about Adam and Eve in the second chapter there isn't in the first one. And he sort of characterizes Adam and Eve in the first chapter as scientists, people who just want to know how the world works. Whereas in the second chapter, they want to know why. And they feel in their aloneness, they feel a sensitivity even to God, that God is both present. And one of the things about God is that God is both present and absent. Soloveitchik says later in the book, he says, Adam says about God, what are these footsteps, that I hear and I turn around and there's nothing there, right? God is both present and absent for us, because God is abstract, God is infinite, and yet God is very personal in Judaism. That's a bit of a contradiction. And so in a certain sense, all human beings are lonely because there's a loneliness for God. So the nature of the dilemma can be stated in a three-word sentence, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, I am lonely. Let me emphasize, however, that by stating I am lonely, I don't intend to convey that I'm alone. I'm not alone. I have people to talk to. I have loved ones. Yet companionship and friendship do not alleviate the passional experience of loneliness, which trails me constantly. He says, even among lots of people, I'm lonely. I'm lonely because at times I feel rejected and thrust away by everybody, not excluding my most intimate friends. In the words of the psalmist, my father and mother have forsaken me, ring very true. Strange, alas, absurd, which is an objective awareness rather than a subjective feeling. On the other hand, it's undeniably true that this basic awareness expresses itself in a variety of ways. whole gamut of one's emotional life extremely responsive to that. Therefore, it is my intent to analyze this experience at both levels, the ontological, with just a root awareness, and historical. He says in the, here he talks about why he's lonely. So let me spell out the passional experience of contemporary man of faith, right? He's the contemporary man of faith. He's living in the 50s, 60s, right? That's modernism. It's a time of modernism. We live at a different era. Postmodernism is slightly different, but in modernism, the 1940s, 50s, 60s, even 70s, you know, there's science is sort of the thing. You know, human beings have found the answer through science. That's sort of the middle part of the 20th century. It's very different now, but that was kind of a general cultural outlook. He looks upon himself as a stranger in modern society, right? He's the man of faith. So the man of faith sees himself as a stranger in modern society, which is technically minded, self-centered, self-loving, almost in a sickly narcissistic fashion, scoring honor upon honor, piling up victory upon victory, right? This is the human being who creates the atom bomb, the human being who tames, you know, the weather, and I mean, this is even before the internet, but the human being is empowered during the middle of the 20th century. Reaching for the distant galaxies and seeing in the here and now sensible world the only manifestation of being, right after the Second World War, all these things are invented and created, and the human being all of a sudden can fly around the world. How can a man of faith like myself, living in a doctrine which has no technical potential, by a law which cannot be tested in the laboratory, steadfast in his loyalty to an eschatological vision, that means a eschatology is things beyond this world, whose fulfillment cannot be predicted by any degree of probability, let alone certainty, even by the most complex advanced mathematical calculations, what can such a man say to a functional utilitarian society, which is so oriented toward, toward the secular, and whose practical reasons of the mind have long ago supplanted the sensitive reasons of the heart? He says, I'm a man of the heart, I'm a man of faith. He says, I'm living in a world in which science is the only measure of being, and power is the measure of being. I am alone. It would be worthwhile to add the following in order to place the dilemma in the proper focus. I've never been seriously troubled by the problem of the biblical doctrine of creation. I skip a few pages here. Here is the line I mentioned. Who is he, right? Adam in the second chapter of Bereshit, the Adam who is alone says, who is he, meaning God, who trails me steadily, uninvited and unwanted like an everlasting shadow and vanishes into the recesses of transcendence the very instant I turn around to confront his numinous, awesome, and mysterious he. Who is he who fills Adam with awe and bliss and humility? And he's describing the man of faith, who is much deeper than just somebody who believes. It's somebody who feels like a foreigner in the technological world. Who is he to whom Adam clings in passionate, all-consuming love? Fascinates Adam. Who is he whom Adam experiences the mysterium tremendum, the great mystery, right? A religious human being experiences the world as a place of great mystery. I mean, that is so different than the world of science, in which the goal is to know everything, and everything can be broken down. There is no mystery left. Even though modern physics has a tremendous amount of mystery, the thought is, you know, essentially there's a philosopher in Australia, very well known, who writes about consciousness, and he brings up the question of the hard or soft question of consciousness. And that is, right, we have a brain. Our brain is made of tissue. And yet we have a personal personality. We have a sense of ourself. We have a sense of, we can't imagine not being. You know, there's all these, our consciousness seems to be much more than the sum of just a bunch of neural connections. And that's a very big question in philosophy. And is if you had enough neural connections, would you then have a human being or no? Is there something fundamentally different about consciousness that comes from the brain? You know, the scientist says, well, no, there can't be anything else. There's only the brain. So if the brain's very complex, what you're going to get is consciousness. But there are some philosophers that say, no, consciousness seems to be something totally different. It seems to be something a little higher, something a little different than just complexity. And there's a mystery inherent in the consciousness that emerges from the brain, because it's not just more so, it's very different. So that's the idea here, is that the religious person lives with a sense of mystery and therefore feels, at least in Rabbi Soloveitchik's view, like a foreigner, feels alone, cannot be under, right? If for Rabbi Soloveitchik, this is a sense of not being understood, right? There's a loneliness in not being understood, right? By the way, I want to go to something. I found an article by Rabbi Mark Katz, very nice article about loneliness. And that's precisely what he says, loneliness. He says, what exactly causes loneliness? It's not necessarily the absence of people, since some of us feel whole in solitude. Menachem of Breslov used to escape into the forest to commune with God, called the Disposedus, and he was very content. Conversely, the presence of others is not always the answer. Some of us feel lonely in the most crowded of places. So to address loneliness, it's important to understand where it comes from. Loneliness is found in the space between the person you know yourself to be and the people in your life who can see you that way. That's a very interesting idea. Imagine you're getting divorced and few people in your life know it. They continue to relate to you as normal, but you carry around a secret. No one sees you as you really are, broken and suffering, loss of your relationship. It creates a distance between you and others. Alone in the knowledge of your upended life, you're like an island of pain, loneliness inevitably follows. In other words, it is being known. That's what he says not being lonely is. When we come to be known by others as we are, the more we are known by others, the less we feel alone, right? You could live with somebody, get a very good relationship, but if the person isn't present for you, if they don't understand you, we live in a world now, everybody's on their phones all the time, right? No one's ever present. So that's going to produce a tremendous amount of loneliness because you can just, no one's ever focused on each other. You know, like it's, even when it's not during COVID, right? We're all always checking our phones. So, I mean, everybody under, you know, whatever, 60, I don't know. But, kids, it's even worse with kids, right? I mean, they're like never looking at who's in front of them. They're only looking at who's not in front of them. It's this funny thing, right? Why don't you text the person who's sitting in front of you? You know, that's absurd. But, we're never here. We're always over there. So nobody can ever feel sort of understood. And so I think that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying. He's saying, I have everything, Rabbi Soloveitchik says. I got friends. I got knowledge. I got all these things. He says, but ultimately, I'm not understood. I live in a universe. I live at a time in society. When I'm from Mars. I'm from somewhere else. And so there's a loneliness inherent in not being understood. I want to finish with Rabbi Nachman. Rabbi Nachman talks a lot about solitude, what he calls hispodidus. Now, hispodidus is a kind of meditative process. Meditation is alive and well in Rabbi Nachman. But it's not necessarily, sitting and saying om. It is a kind of Rabbi Nachman, first of all, felt that solitude is a tremendous prerequisite for getting to a deep place and connecting with God. And you'll see it here in this Torah. So he bases this Torah Nun Beis, in Rabbi Nachman. There's a book of Rabbi Nachman's work called Likut Maran. There's more than one book of Rabbi Nachman's that we have. I mean, he didn't write any of them. They're all written down by a student Rabbi Nachman, who lived wrote them down then. And they're, from what we understand, it's pretty accurate. And so this was chapter 52. So it's based on a mission. The mission says, it is a mission for Gavis. Rechinina ben Chachinai Omer. Rechinina said, Haneir Balaila, one who is awake at night, Mahalech Bederech Yechidi, and goes on the way alone, walks alone, maybe at night, V'mafano Liba Levatala, one who turns their heart to idle matters, Hareze Meschayev Benafsho, they are obligated for their soul. They are, that idea of obligated for their soul means like they're sort of, almost like deserving of the death penalty, something like. So Menachem takes this Mishnah and does a whole other thing with it. I quote the Mishnah. He says, there are apikursim, there are heretics, and they believe that the world exists of necessity. The world has to exist. And he says they think they can prove it. The world exists of necessity. It has to exist, right? That it's existed forever, right? Aristotle felt that. He says, Abu Be'emes, but in truth, that's not true. Be'emes ha'ola meloar hu efshari ha'metziyot. He says, actually, the world and everything in the universe is contingent. It exists on contingency. It doesn't have to exist. These are philosophical terms, right? Something that exists of necessity means it cannot, even in theory, be another way. It's not dependent on anything. But he says, no, the world actually it exists on contingency. It's dependent on things. Only God is mechuyav hametziyot. Only God is obligated to exist. That's what it literally means, but it means exists of necessity. God's existence is the fundamental existence. I'm going to skip the paragraph. It says, "V'ikra kavana shabar kala olam b'shvili Yisrael." God created the world for the Jewish people. The Jewish people have a job in the world. What is that job? That they'll do God's will. Shiachsu v'davik b'sharashan, and that they will return and cleave to their spiritual root. What is their spiritual root? Tahinu shiachsu v'chal bo yisbarach, that they will cleave to God. Shehu mechayev metzias, because God exists of necessity. Right? Human beings can connect to that which exists necessarily. B'shvil ne'zeh never come. He says that's why everything was created. Nimtza kol ma sheyisrael osin ritzon shemachem, whenever the Jewish people are doing God's will and they're connected to their roots, they become, if you're connected to God, you become, you tap into this sort of existence of necessity, this necessary existence. And you bring the whole world with you into a state of necessary existence. And that's why it was created. So v'al kein, az davka kesh'os ritzono, only when we're doing God's will, only then is the world subsumed into the concept of existing of necessity, right? Fundamentally existing. Anything that does God's will more, they bring themselves in the world to existing of necessity. Because they're doing God's will, and they become connected to the divine. So, how do you do this? How do you connect to the unity of God, which connects you to the existing of necessity? You can only do it through bittul, through nullification. That's very interesting. The concept of chassidut, of the nullification of the self. Right? This connects to aloneness, we'll see, right? To loneliness. Sheyivatel atzmo legamri, to nullify yourself completely, until you become subsumed into the divine unity. So how do you come to that level of self-nullification? It comes from being alone. It comes from being in solitude. It comes from something meditative. It's through the process of hispodidus, and I'll explain what that is, that one nullifies the self, right? And this is a kind of, you're not lonely, this is a kind of extreme solitude in which you actually lose your sense of self and you become subsumed into the divine. Through being alone and speaking to God in your own terms, through that you nullify all of your desires. And you end up nullifying all of your physicality. I don't even know what that means. And then you become subsumed into God's root. And when should you do this meditation? When should you do this solitude in order to achieve the sense of bittul, of nullification of the self? At night. When? Because you have to do it at a time when the world is empty from all of the tirda, from all of the pursuing of this world. During the day, everybody's running after the things of this world. They're working, they're doing this, they're shopping. And that confuses us. We can't connect to God during the daytime because everybody's so busy running after things, and that confuses us. It jumbles us. Even if you're in a place of solitude, even if you're, you know, sitting back and trying to meditate, doesn't matter. Because the world is pursuing the world, because people are pursuing the world during the day, so you'll never come to bittul. You are impacted by your surroundings. So he says, in fact, this hispodidus, this meditation, this solitude has to not only be at night, it has to be in a specific place. It has to be outside of a city. It has to be in the forest. Where people don't walk. Because even if it's a place where people only walk during the day, because they're chasing after this world, it's going to have resonance there. Even though now they're not walking there, it's not going to work. You have to find a place where people don't walk. Has to be at night, has to be outside a city, probably in the forest, and it's got to be not on a path where people walk during the day to do their business. then yachol ispat lechal b'yos barach alken tzarch sheyach levada b'layla. So how do you do this work? You have to go by yourself in the night, b'makom she'ein shamadim, where there is no person. Shami yachis, but in there you have to go and be alone. Now this is not loneliness, right? This is a profound sense of, it's ironic, there's a loss of the self, and yet precisely in that loss of the self does one gain themselves, their true self, God. And it's fascinating. V'yafana libo v'da'ata mikol iskeil mazeh, and you won't be connected to anything going on in this world. Yivatla kol, everything will be nullified. Ajizuchim is bitul b'emes. Then you'll achieve the concept of true bitul, true nullification. V'chein yinayig zman rav v'spodidus. Should do that a lot. And he says, this is actually what the Mishnah is talking about. How does that work? Atatira pilaplos. Now you'll see a wonder, he says. Look back at the Mishnah. Haneir balayla, one who is awake at night. Kipshuta dainu shener balayla spoded. It's referring, he says, to meditation, to this solitude. V'amahalich, he said it has to be at night. V'amahalich b'derech echidi, one who goes on the way alone. He says, it's not talking about something you shouldn't do, it's something you should do. That is going out into the forest alone at night to do his spodidus, to have this solitude, this meditation. Mufana liba levatala. And now in the pshat meant one who makes their heart idle. But he says, no, it's batala, which means nullification. You nullify your sense of self. Shemafana liba koska lemedeh. You nullify yourself from all the things of this world in order to nullify yourself into the divine. Hareze meschayev benafsha. This one, now the pshat is he's obligated for his own soul. Right? He's obligated to the death penalty. He says, not what it means. You become mischayev. Mitchayev means obligated, but it also means of necessity. Your soul exists of necessity because you've tuned into the divine. Through this meditation, through this solitude, you can be mavatal yourself. You can nullify yourself until your soul becomes subsumed into the divine and begins to exist of necessity, not contingency. It is a nichla kol olam imnasha b'chiv ha-metzios, and you can bring the whole world with you. Nasha b'chol olam b'chiv ha-metzios, can make the whole world and yourself exist of necessity. And this is what it means, mischayev b'nafsha. So Rabbi Nachman turns the whole Mishnah on its head. Instead of being a bad thing, it becomes a good thing. What is it? It's how you tune into the divine, which exists of necessity, by going at night into the forest. So go somewhere where it's safe, I guess, but I have to be careful. I did this once, but then I got attacked. No, I wasn't doing anything so holy. I was just walking home. But if you can find the right place, he says, so very interesting, right? Rabbi Nachman, I'm going to finish with this. Rabbi Nachman is saying that solitude is incredibly profound. This is not loneliness, right? This is solitude. And in that, even though you may lose yourself, you may find something much, much bigger. You find sort of your true self. So it's not so easy to do, but hopefully our loneliness during COVID, we can find ways to transform it from the loneliness of Adam and maybe even from the loneliness of Rabbi Soloveitchik to the loneliness of Rabbi Nachman. And obviously if you feel lonely and depressed, that's a different story. You have to go find help. But it's fitting to think about how do we transform our loneliness into solitude, into something that perhaps more productive. And what does that look like? So thanks all for coming on.
Thank you, Rabbi. And,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Merit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Truly should have solitude and not feel loneliness.
Thank you very much.
Good to be with you again tonight.
Thanks,
Simon. Thank you, Rabbi. Bye.
Bye-bye.